Our first case this morning is United States against Parrish. Counsel for the defense. This is a 15-minute case, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah.
Please proceed.
Good morning. The Army Court exceeded its fact-finding authority by resolving a post-trial collateral issue upon conflicting affidavits. The appellate requests that this court set aside the Army Court's findings and remand the case for a debate hearing. This would allow the trial judge to hear the evidence, make findings of fact and conclusions of law that the Army Court could then properly review under its Article 66C authority. Appellant asserted a post-trial claim that the government failed to fulfill a material term of the pre-trial agreement. In support of this claim, he submitted an affidavit from himself, an affidavit from his wife, and a letter from the staff judge advocate defining the convening authority's understanding of the terms of the agreement. Upon receiving these filings, the Army Court determined that the record as a whole was unclear whether that term that the appellant was asserting was in fact a part of the agreement. And therefore, the court ordered further affidavits from the two trial counsel, the two defense counsel, and the SJA. These affidavits conflicted with appellants in that they stated that no Sarosa agreement existed. However, the facts contained in those affidavits also, in some way, support appellants' allegations. In resolving the issue, the Army Court relied upon the fourth Ginn factor to state that the record as a whole, as well as the appellate filings, compellingly demonstrated that appellant's assertions were improbable. In this case, neither the record as a whole nor the appellate filings compellingly demonstrate the improbability of appellant's assertions.
Does the record as a whole include the PTA?
It does, Your Honor.
The judge's discussion with the appellant.
It does, Your Honor, and the reason that the pretrial, or the care inquiry, doesn't necessarily resolve the issue on its face is that appellant gave a rational and reasonable explanation of why his statements at trial are inconsistent with his assertions on appeal. In particular, he stated that his understanding was based upon a detailed discussion of the pretrial agreement with his defense counsel. And that discussion included the deferral of the adjudged and statutory forfeitures, of pay allowances, and the reduction of rank. And it was based upon that detailed discussion that he understood a condition of the agreement would include receipt of E7 pay from the date of trial until action.
Well, counsel, where is there in any of these papers that are before us in the appellate record, where is there any evidence of a sub rosa agreement? It appears to me that your client in his affidavit is basically saying, based on discussions with my attorney and maybe with others, I was informed that this is what the agreement said. And I was kind of misled in that way. But I don't see anything in that affidavit or in any of the other papers that allege the existence of a sub rosa agreement.
Looking at a sub rosa agreement, Your Honor, if you look at it solely as whether an unwritten agreement exists, then that is what we have before the court.
We don't have a misunderstanding of advice from his attorney, which appears what he's saying in his affidavit.
Whether it's a misunderstanding or a sub rosa agreement isn't really dispositive in this case, because a sub rosa agreement contains some sort of connotation that there's something purposefully being hidden from the court. And in this case, it doesn't appear that that's what occurred. What appears to have occurred was that all parties understood that deferral of reduction was negotiated, was included in the agreement, and would occur in this case.
So you're not relying on a sub rosa agreement?
Not to the extent that there was any purposeful hiding of the ball from the trial judge.
But you relied on a mutual mistake?
It was either a mutual The essential question appears to be whether this was a material, whether this was a term of the pretrial agreement, and
I'm asking whether this is some form of mutual mistake.
And that's what we don't know, and that's what we need to debate here to determine. Because if it is a mutual mistake, then there was no meeting of the minds in the past pleas and improvement. If there was a meeting of the minds and there was no mutual mistake, then it was a term of the pretrial agreement. And we should make sure that he receives either the benefit
or... Saying there's a sub-rosa agreement which there doesn't seem to be any evidence of, or there was a mutual mistake.
If, and just so I'm trying to be clear here, if we're saying the sub-rosa agreement simply means that there was an unwritten term, then there was a sub-rosa agreement. But that is not necessarily what the affidavits from the government are answering, because the connotation to sub-rosa means something else that they might be answering.
Counsel, maybe it would be helpful if we focus on English rather than Latin here.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is... My understanding from your petition supplement is that there is a possibility that there is an agreement between the trial counsel and the defense counsel that was not articulated at trial.
Correct, Your Honor.
Secondly, there's a possibility that there was misadvice from the defense counsel to the client, and that is the problem here, and that there was no agreement whatsoever between trial counsel and defense counsel, but there's a problem instead of misadvice and reliance on misadvice. That was one of your arguments in the petition supplement.
Is that correct?
Then there's a third possibility, that there was mutual misunderstanding on everybody's part. Nobody really understood how the law worked, and that operated to the disadvantage of your client. And then the fourth possibility, which you don't acknowledge, but the government argues, is that there's no agreement, no misadvice. So are those the four possibilities that we have here? Three of them articulated in your petition and one by the government. That is, one, no agreement, no misadvice. Two, no agreement but misadvice. Three, mutual misunderstanding of all parties. And four, sub rosa agreement between the parties.
Those are the four possibilities, Your Honor. However, what appears to be clear is that it's not just misadvice from his defense counsel, but the trial counsel stated that that was a negotiated term, whereas the defense counsel in his affidavit says he doesn't recall any conversations.
I thought that your argument was that you needed a Dubé hearing to settle all this, as opposed to it being clear that we know what's going on.
And it's really not clear what the underlying facts are. And that's the real issue before the court here today, is did the Army Corps have sufficient information in those affidavits to resolve the issue before the court, and they did not. And again, this court specifically said that the Army Corps cannot rely on post-trial affidavits in part to resolve these post-trial collateral claims. And the Army Corps specifically states in their 10 October 2006 decision that the affidavits themselves are what compellingly demonstrate to the court the improbability of appellant's assertions. It's appellant's position that the record as a whole, near the affidavits, can make that compelling demonstration to this court, and that a reasonable person could look at these affidavits and still determine that it is possible that a deferment of reduction was an agreed-upon term between the appellant and the government. And that is looking at the record as a whole, as well as those affidavits. And again, it goes back to why the care inquiry isn't necessarily sufficient, because the counsel explained why his understanding of those terms at the time of trial is different, or is the same from his point of view, as well as everybody else's on appeal. However,
so Collins arguing as to why, unless I'm mistaken, it took 2 years to notice this issue.
And that's another fact that is unclear on the record, and the reason the debate hearing is necessary, because it's unclear exactly when the appellant learned that his wife was not being paid at the proper rate. Her affidavit specifically says that she went to the government to resolve this issue, and that she spoke to the trial counsel, who assured her she would receive the settlement.
Does the record reflect when it was first raised in the judicial channel?
It does reflect when it was first raised in the It was first raised in the judicial channels when the supplemental appellate brief was filed with the Army Court in August of 2005.
And
About 2004.
The CA's action?
The community theater's action was in January of 2003, Your Honor.
Was Colin represented by counsel during this time period?
He was, Your Honor. However, the appeals department was aware sometime before August of 2004 because his affidavit was dated in April of 2004, as well as his wife's affidavit being dated at that time. And apparently that would be when he first learned of the improper payment that his wife was receiving at that time. And again, it goes back to we don't know for sure when that discussion occurred between them, because her indication in her affidavit is that all of her communications regarding receiving his pay was based upon her conversations with the trial counsel and the SJ, and not on her going to the defendant in order to try to obtain this deferred reduction or the proper payments. And there's some indication in the record as well that this agreement existed, because even in the SJA's affidavit, he states that making sure the appellant received, or the appellant's wife's received, his paycheck was an inducement to the community authority to accept the appellant's plea. So even when the Army Corps looks to these affidavits and selectively picks out the facts that support, saying it compellingly demonstrates the improbability of the appellant's assertions, they ignore these other statements in those same affidavits that would seem to imply there was some sort of agreement. There was a negotiation with the defense counsel and the trial counsel. And the trial counsel clearly remembers that negotiation and clearly remembers agreeing that that could be included and would be included in the agreement. And he clearly remembers that the reason for that was to make sure the wife received the maximum benefit she could, the maximum help she could after dealing with this trial. Because the Army Court resolved this collateral issue upon conflicting affidavits, that they would conflict in one way with the appellant's assertions, in some way support that allegation, and because we do not have enough facts to know exactly how to resolve this issue, the appellant requests that this court set aside the finding of the Army Court and remand this case for a debate hearing. And it's at this point that the Army Court could then properly review this collateral issue under its Article 66 powers.
What precisely is it that you would want the debate hearing to inquire into?
The debate hearing should clearly inquire into when the appellant learned of this, first of all. However, they should also inquire into what the understandings of the parties were at the time of trial. And there's some significant questions as to why the trial counsel changed his mind after his February email, which was part of the appellate filings, where he stated, "I clearly remember this was part of the agreement, and I clearly remember why it was part of the agreement." And yet, 3 months later, he states the exact opposite. And again, the same question goes to the community or the SJ. Why would you state that the understanding of the convening authority at 8 months after trial was that the deferral would be at the E7 rate? And yet, 3 years later, what did you rely upon? What did you use? How did you make this determination that you were just an error and that wasn't necessarily part of the agreement? And again, there's, to some extent, a credibility determination, Your Honor, in the Army Court's decision. And this court has stated that the Army Court, or any service court, is not permitted to make a credibility determination on the basis of conflicting affidavits. And that credibility determination is properly resolved only at a trial court level. If there's no further questions.
You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Captain Mark Goodson, and I, along with Major Elizabeth Murata, represent the United States in this appeal. The Army Court of Criminal Appeals correctly applied this court's test in the United States v. Ginn when it made fact-finding in this case. It used the affidavits to decide that no debate hearing was needed, but then did not use those affidavits and look to the record of trial and materials outside of the affidavits in reaching its conclusions as to findings of fact that there was no sub rosa agreement and that appellant understood fully the operation and effect of his pretrial agreement. At ACCA, the collateral attack to this agreement on two bases, as noted by the court. First, that there was a subrogation agreement, and second, that he misunderstood the operation of his agreement. ACCA went through a two-step process. First, they ordered affidavits. And then they conducted, second, they conducted a fact-finding based on materials other than the affidavits. So this case is not so much a case of conflicting affidavits as it is a case of conflicts between what appellant said at trial and in his clemency petition and the statements he made in his appellate affidavits. I could apply the fourth Ginn factor in each of its determination here. This court said in the United States to be Fagan that the fourth Ginn factor, and I quote, requires an assessment of that portion of the appellate filings in the record as a whole, apart from the conflicting affidavits, and a determination of whether that broader framework compellingly demonstrates the improbability of the factual assertions made by the appellant underlying the claim. So Fagan presupposes that in applying the fourth Ginn factor, the service court will have access to conflicting affidavits, and will have considered them, but that the service court will mask those affidavits when arriving at its findings of fact. And that's precisely what happened here. If you look at pages 10 and 11 and 12 of the memorandum decision of memorandum opinion of October 2006 in ACCA's decision, you'll note that on page 12, it reaches at the bottom of the page, the court reaches its findings of fact. It mentions, based on the foregoing analysis, we're looking back at pages 10 and 11, what is that analysis? The court carefully enumerates different sets of facts. The pretrial agreement, the statements of appellate before the military judge, the post-trial submissions of appellant. In each instance, the Army Court is relying on matters other than the affidavit materials and conflicting affidavits to the extent there's conflict. The government does not acknowledge conflict, but the fact of the matter is the Army Court did precisely what this court said it should do in Fagan.
The government's view as to why so many government attorneys seem to be confused about what the agreement said, and why so many government attorneys seem to want to be to concede the issue.
With respect to the different attorneys, the first attorney that seemed that might have seemed at first glance to be confused would have been the trial counsel. The only evidence we have of trial counsel's confusion on this matter appears in an email, an unsworn statement, which he responded to off the cuff in response to Governor Appellate Division's inquiry as to what the pretrial agreement was. Well, as far as we know, the trial counsel only knew of the written pretrial agreement. His off-the-cuff recollection... Colonel Shea, sir? Yes, sir. Colonel Shea's, you have... his explanation is simply that he made a mistake. That,
best for the government, this, everybody on the government side operates off the cuff, doesn't bother to check things, writes letters that they haven't reviewed or checked. That's your falsely your position.
No, sir, it's not. It does happen on occasion. In this instance, as far as the email is concerned, the request was from Governor Appellate Counsel was
Isn't there a likelihood if you get a request like that, you might be creating something that might appear before a court?
There is, Your Honor.
So you just give whatever comes to mind at the time and send it back?
That may be. As a matter of fact, this was between two, a government appellate counsel and a former government appellate counsel. I don't know that the trial counsel in this case was aware that this might ever wind up in front of a court, but the fact of the matter is he was not trying to conceal anything. He was simply given his independent recollection, to use the language as requested by the Government Appellate Council. When questioned under oath by the Army Court, when we had the opportunity to reflect on what really happened,
you would agree, though, that under oath can't be the standard for doing good staff work.
It was never the same, but we all are sometimes asked to give independent recollections or off-the-cuff recollections, and that means...
I shouldn't have to put you under oath there in order to get an accurate answer, should I?
Not in an email, sir.
Are you under oath right now, for example?
Not to my knowledge, sir.
Uh,
Continuing not under oath here. Continuing not under oath here.
Yes, sir.
We have, as Judge Baker has noted, the misadvice of the staff judge advocate, the incorrect, as you suggest, recollection of the trial counsel, the government's concession, or whatever it was, at the Court of Criminal Appeals suggesting that specific performance would be allowed in this case. In light of those things, and assuming that there was no sub rosa agreement, why do those factors compellingly demonstrate that the appellant's affidavit, when he said that he was advised by his defense counsel that he would receive, that there would be continued pay at the E7 rate, why does that compellingly demonstrate that that's incorrect?
Because for the very reasons that the Army Court gave in its opinion, the pretrial agreement said nothing about deferral of rank reduction. On the contrary, it contained an integration clause and said any other lawfully judged punishment could be approved. The military judge thoroughly discussed the pretrial agreement with and the quantum of agreement. And the trial counsel, defense counsel, and appellant each agreed that no outside agreements existed. Insofar as a misunderstanding is concerned, the Army Court also made findings, in fact, that appellant thoroughly understood the operation of his pretrial agreement, and they did so based upon, among other things, his high GT score, looking at the fact that he was fully capable of understanding these things.
So the staff judge advocate, when he wrote to the wife and said, given the complexities of these issues, I can understand how confusion can arise. Confusion can arise then, and I don't mean to be conclusory here, but it seems that confusion can arise with respect to a staff judge advocate and a trial counsel and a appellate counsel who's making a submission to the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. Why couldn't confusion then arise on the part of the accused in believing that, given the complexity of these pay matters, that continued pay at the E7 rate was incorporated into the agreement to which he agreed, so that when he appeared at trial and he was asked if this is everything, he said, yeah, this is everything.
It is possible, Your Honor, that could have happened, but the Army Court found as a matter of fact that was not the case. And the issue in this case, before this court, is not so much whether if we were to look at the findings of fact, that would be reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard. That conclusion is not clearly erroneous. The question for this court is whether the methodology employed by the Army Court was appropriate in doing so.
That's right. Isn't the question whether, in light of these materials before the Army Court, the affidavits, the letters, the emails, whether that appellate record compellingly demonstrates that the accused's understanding is incorrect?
And to be clear, Your Honor, this court's decision in Fagan says we do not look to those competing affidavits, the information contained in the conflicting affidavits. In order to apply the fourth Ginn factor, this court must consider proportionally appellate filings and quoting them, appellate filings and the record as a whole, apart from conflicting affidavits, end quote. So,
isn't the question really, counsel, whether you look at the conflicting affidavits to see if there's a conflict, and if there is no conflict, then that suggests one resolution. If there is a conflict, that suggests another resolution. But the question here is, the lower court appears to have said no debate hearing because appellant's assertion that he didn't understand the term to mean what he now says it means is contradicted by the trial record, right? I'm not talking about the Fagan court. I'm talking about the CCA in this case.
I'm sorry, if you could repeat your question.
Sure. I mean, they didn't look at the appellate filings, the affidavits, to determine whether it was inherently improbable. What they said is, we believe that his claim now that there is this additional understanding about what the term in the pretrial agreement means is flatly contradicted by the record, by the inquiry into the providency agreement, the inquiry into the pretrial agreement, and the actual terms of the pretrial agreement.
That is correct.
Okay. And so the question is, were they right when they said that?
Yes, they were, Your Honor.
Okay. And how is anything that was in the providency inquiry or anything that's in the pretrial agreement, how does any of that go to what he understood the term to mean? Did the military judge ask him what he understood that term to mean?
They specifically covered the portion of the quantum agreement and the military judge asked if he understood that, and the appellant said, yes, he did. I'm looking at the trial transcript at page 51. The military judge reviewed the highest possible sentence and turned to the appellant and said, do you understand that? Yes, ma'am. Do you have any questions as to the sentence that could be imposed as a result of your guilty plea? No, ma'am. Then goes on to page 52 and said, ask whether this contained all the agreements. Then ask whether any promises not written into the agreement appeared there. And then on page 53, whether it's a full and complete agreement with no other agreements. The appellant said that this was, in fact, the case. Then on page 57, it says that Roman numeral 2 of the pretrial agreement, and of course the military judge is not looking at the agreement at that point, but said, wanted to know if he'd read that portion of the agreement himself. And does that agreement correctly state the agreement that he and General Jackson had agreed to?
Okay, let me ask you this question first. What is your position as to whether or not there's any conflict between what the appellant's affidavits say and what the government's affidavits say? Is it your position that there's no conflict whatsoever?
Strictly speaking, Your Honor, it's that there is not a conflict. Strictly speaking, and that's set forth in our brief.
What about reasonably as opposed to strictly speaking? Do you think that a reasonable interpretation of all the appellate material submitted pursuant to the lower court's order with respect to affidavits, do you think a reasonable person looking at those would think that there was a conflict as to what had happened? As opposed to strictly, could a reasonable person think that there was a difference?
With respect to the understanding only, there might be, Your Honor.
Okay. And given that what the appellant actually says, at least in the affidavit that I have, isn't that there was an additional term, it's that he understood the specific term to have a different meaning. So it's not a question of a separate term in the pretrial agreement that isn't there, that's sub rosa, that was somehow not included. It's what he was told that a term meant. I mean, isn't that what he's saying?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what in the providency inquiry or in the pretrial agreement goes to what he was told that term meant?
There's nothing that specifically addresses rank reduction, but nor would there ever be in the event of something that simply isn't there. I mean, you're asking, in effect, the government to prove a negative, or the court would be asking that, I should say. The fact of the matter is, if you look up, you can also consider, and this court may also consider, and the Army Court could consider, the post-trial submissions of the appellant. Look at his petition for clemency. In the petition for clemency, appellant is, or his attorney at least, is complaining of the fact that appellant's wife is in dire financial distress. The car is about to be repossessed. And what does appellant do? He thanks the convening authority for deferral of waiver and forfeiture without one mention of any problems as to the amount of payment, the sequence and timing of the payment. There's nothing about that. There's nothing. His inaction belies his post-trial claim or appellate claim at the 11th hour that he somehow misunderstood his agreement. The fact of the matter is, we don't have to have a smoking gun here for the Army Court to have concluded that appellant understood the operational effect of his pretrial agreement. This can be built on a circumstantial case. That was a proper exercise of the Army Court's findings of fact.
Counsel, you're running out of time. You raise in your brief the possibility that GIN 5 would support this as well as GIN 4.
Yes, sir.
Does the government have a position as to which is the better argument, GIN 4 or GIN 5, or is it just an alternative you threw out there?
No, it's not just an alternative. I would say it would be actually GIN 5, Your Honor, because that's consistent with this court's position in the Mueller case. Any way we look at this, whether it's GIN 4 or GIN 5, we doing the same thing that this court did in Moore, the Waver case we cite in our brief. Look at what appellant is saying now, and look at what appellant said at trial, without respect to the affidavits. So if I may briefly conclude.
Counsel, just to see if I understand your point, then, with respect to the SJA's comments, the trial counsel's comments, and the appellate filing, that no one can consider that as to whether there is, in fact, a material fact that has to be resolved in the debate proceeding. That is, that if, in fact, the appellant in this case had the same misunderstanding that the SJA, the trial counsel, and the appellate counsel had at some point, no one can give any consideration to that?
Well, I don't want to say that no consideration can be given to that. I would take issue that it was the same misunderstanding that the SJA or the trial...
I'm not asserting that it is. I'm saying if it were. That is, if, as a result of a hearing that were demonstrated, is it the government's position we could never get to that hearing, even if that may be the fact in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, because of appellant's statements at trial and in his post-trial submissions. The Fagan court stated that Dem requires a hearing, and I'm quoting, only if the opposing affidavits raise a fact dispute that is material to the resolution of post-trial trial and the claim cannot be otherwise resolved through the application of the five Dem factors. And one of those is the fourth, as the other court used.
I understand your position. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, if you'd like to conclude, please do so.
Please, just briefly. This court should affirm the Army Court of Criminal Appeals decision because the Army Court properly applied the Dem factors in this case. Appellant has failed to show that ACCA abused its discretion in ordering affidavits or that it abused its discretion in applying the Dem test to determining that there was no subrogation agreement and that he thoroughly understood his pretrial agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant's counsel have rebuttal?
It's difficult for the government to state that the Army Court did not rely upon the affidavits to resolve the collateral issue. In the first order from the court, 17 March 2005, the Army Court had before it the complete record, including the care inquiry, as well as the 1105 submissions. And at that time, they said the record is unclear and may require further affidavits. In May of 2005, after receiving affidavits, the Army Court stated again, we have considered what has been submitted to date, and they still required a further affidavit from Colonel Shea. And then, in their final decision, they stated very clearly, the affidavits demonstrate the improbability of appellant's assertions. The Army Court relied upon those affidavits, and those affidavits either conflict in that appellant states there was an agreement, and the government's affidavit states there was not an affidavit, there was not an agreement, or the government's affidavits in some way support appellant's assertions by reflecting that this was negotiated, that it was important to him, that it was known that it was important to all parties, that it was an inducement to the convenient deity to accept his pretrial offer, because the convenient deity wanted to ensure that benefit to appellant's wife and daughter, who was the victim in this case. Because the Army Court resolved this issue by exceeding its fact-finding authority and misapplying the fourth Dem factor to determine that they were compellingly, it was compellingly demonstrated to them that the appellant's assertions were unreasonable.
Does it make any difference if you go under the fifth Dem factor that doesn't have the compellingly demonstrated language?
It does not, Your Honor, because when we're analyzing Dem, this court originally went to the civilian authorities to basically frame that issue, saying that appellant would be bound by his statements at trial unless he offers a reasonable explanation as to why his appellate assertions are inconsistent. And in this case, the appellant has given a reasonable explanation. And that explanation was that I understood that term at the time of trial to include what I'm alleging now is part of my agreement. And that is a rational explanation, given the fact that the SJA himself reviewed those exact same terms and wrote a letter to the appellant's wife stating that he understood those terms and he knew that they understood those terms to include deferred forfeitures at the E7 rate.
Are you suggesting that the care inquiry was inadequate?
No, Your Honor, because the does nothing to require the military judge to go into the specific terms of the, he has to go into the terms, but what happened in this case is he asked the appellant's understanding, and it's, but he wasn't required to. What he failed to do was to go into what the parties actually expected that term to play out.
Their inquiry is adequate on the other hand. It was reasonable for the appellant not to understand what he was agreeing to with the military judge.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the delta there that you're trying to explore.
Yes, Your Honor. And like I said, we're not trying to fight the military judge, but if you had explored that, how the actual agreement would play out with forfeitures after trial, perhaps the care inquiry itself would be compelling to demonstrate an improbability.
Is there anything about this appellant that would make it particularly, that would make him any different than any other person going through a care inquiry in terms of whether he'd understand the terms? There's some suggestions in the record that his wife might have had some language barriers in terms of perhaps understanding things. Is that the case with this appellant?
That's not the case with this appellant, and that would not be really dispositive in this case, because even though, as the unquote noted, he has a high GT score and appears competent, the appellant specifically stated that he doesn't understand legal terminology, and he doesn't know the technical terms that would be required in the specifics of the pretrial agreement, and he relied upon his counsel for those terms.
To support that concept as well.
So you have to this?
They also wrote that it was all pretty confusing.
As well as that the SJ himself, with legal training, clearly misstated the law when he wrote that letter.
Counsel, so is it just to make sure that I understand the rule that possibly comes from the argument you seem to be making, is it your suggestion that every time the portion of the pretrial agreement that talks about a judge and statutory forfeitures, for example, the quantum portion of the agreement, that the military, if the military judge doesn't specifically go into what precisely all those things are, that then later, 2, 3, 4 years later, that an appellant can come and say, oh, well, that's not what I understood it to mean? So that when the military judge says, do you agree that this is the only agreement, that you understand what it means, and the appellant says yes, that it can nonetheless be challenged? In all cases, at any time?
No, Your Honor, we're certainly not even requesting that this court impose such a requirement on the military judge to do so. However, on the facts of this case, his failure to do so just means that that care inquiry in this particular case does not compellingly demonstrate. And there may be a different case where those facts post-trial or in the 11 of fines or other part of fines might actually support or not support the appellant's affidavit, but the facts in this case seem to indicate that we need to go further and correctly apply the Ginn factors and resolve this by sending it back to a debate room to find out the facts necessary to determine whether there was an actual understanding between all the parties as to this deferment agreement.
Counsel, to Judge Ryan, did that finish your question? Just to follow up on that, to make clear, is your argument that appellant, with respect to what an appellant could argue in the future, that the problem here is that appellant says now, I misunderstood, period, or is it, I misunderstood because my counsel told me that this is what would happen?
It certainly, in this case, helps appellant that he does give an explanation. Whereas if he failed to give that explanation and just said, period, I made this conclusion, perhaps under the second Ginn factor, then we would have been able to have the Army Corps resolve this matter by saying that he's just making a conclusionary statement.
But as I understand your petition supplement, it was, your complaint is, I misunderstood because my counsel misadvised me, and therefore there is ineffective assistance of counsel.
And certainly that is an underlying fact of play before this court, even though that issue hasn't been granted before this court. But it certainly is underlying this issue itself.
Unless there's anything further, I think we're a little over time now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court thanks counsel for both parties for your arguments. The case is now submitted, and we shall reconvene at 9:45 a.m. Thank you.
Thank you.
file case for this morning is United States against Brown. This also is a 15-minute case. Counsel for appellant.
May it please the court, I am Frank Spinner, and we're together with Captain Pizzer. We represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Brown. Let me begin by saying I bring the court good tidings of great joy in Colorado. The Rockies did lose the over San Diego, so everything's happy, at least in Colorado.
And they don't have video replay in baseball.
This case, I think, has a very straightforward issue. And basically, what happened here is my client was charged with rape. He was convicted of a lesser included offense of indecent assault. The problem developed when the trial judge, was preparing instructions, working with counsel. And the question came up as to this lesser included offense. Because the factual scenario was unclear given the alleged victim's testimony. She basically testified that on the same day, at two separate times, Sergeant Brown inserted his penis into her. And on one occasion, he inserted, of those two occasions, contemporaneous with inserting his penis, he inserted his finger. So the judge crafted an instruction that gave the court members, the five court members in this case, an option of looking at whether or not, as a lesser included offense, if he inserted or inserted his penis or inserted both. However, in her instruction, she did not require the members, or as I found in the instructions anyway, state that the members had to agree by two-thirds vote on one of those three and indicate that in the defendant's worksheet.
Well, didn't the defense attorney specifically ask the military judge or tell the military judge that they did not want that on the findings worksheet?
Regardless of what the defense counsel said.
Well, isn't that important?
Well, no, because I think the judge has a required instruction on the elements of the offense, and the judge has a duty to instruct correctly the law, regardless of
invited error.
Yes, sir. In this case, that's true. I'm not sure I would agree it's invited error. I think
please
the defense counsel missed the point that we needed at least to have a two-thirds vote on one of the three.
What element of indecent assault did the military judge fail to instruct on?
There was not an element that she failed to instruct on.
Okay, so how did the military judge err when she specifically asked the defense counsel if he wanted the instructions to have specific findings with respect to which act it was, and the defense counsel said no? Especially in light of this court's decision in Vidal and the United States Supreme Court's decision in Griffin.
Right. In some of the other cases that have dealt with this area of law, they've talked about the government's theory, or you find that these decisions are made in terms of whether or not an individual is a chief actor or an aider and abettor. In this particular case, when I say invited error, it doesn't excuse the judge from making clear to the members that they must concur by two-thirds vote on one of the three, whether that's included in the findings worksheet or not. So it's not a matter of what does the findings worksheet reflect, it's a matter of what is the instruction. And that's why we cited the case of Garcia Rivera, the Ninth Circuit decision, 353 Fed Third 788, 2003 decision. And that court ruled that the judge's error was instruction, and it was very similar to the situation that we have here, where there were different factual scenarios, and they were instructed on in the disjunctive. And basically, the court said that this was unconstitutional, regardless of the standard of review, abuse of discretion, or plain error. And so the real problem here is not so, in part, it's what's reflected on the findings worksheet. That's part of the problem. But the findings worksheet merely reflects what the members have found.
The instruction, nonetheless, should have said that the members have to concur by two-thirds vote on at least one of those three factual elements.
How do you jibe this with Shad v. Arizona?
Well, Shad v. Arizona was a Captain Moore case. There, the court was, Supreme Court was looking at state law. And I think it was a plurality opinion. And when you look at Shad v. Arizona, what you'll see is, I think in the concurring opinion about Justice Scalia, he basically says this is the way this statute has been forever. We're looking at state of mind in terms of premeditated murder and felony murder. And so we cited Shad v. Arizona just for a general proposition. Clearly, the factual scenario in that case as it developed for the court is different, and the law is different than as it applied in that case in ruling in favor of the government than what we have here.
Well, even the dissent, though, in Shad, brings up the issue of burglary and says, in the case of burglary, for example, the manner of entering is not an element of the crime. Thus, Winship would not require proof beyond a reasonable doubt of such factual details as whether a defendant pried open a window with a screwdriver or a crowbar. Why isn't that your situation here?
Well, the problem is that when you start getting into dicta and getting into these hypotheticals, you can come to different conclusions. All the appellate courts that, in your opinions, that I've read in this area have said that this is very difficult in terms of trying to resolve these issues. Are you talking about a fact? Are you talking about a theory? Are you talking about a state of mind? And again, I have to keep coming back to the Garcia-Rivera decision, because as you look at the case law and the various scenarios in which this issue has arisen, the Garcia-Rivera opinion is the closest to what we have in this particular setting.
Let me ask you a question, counsel. Leaving aside the possibility of invited error or waiver, and leaving aside the fact that all three of these acts appear to have been part of the same precise time period, your allegation appears to be that the way in which your client was harmed is that he doesn't know which of these to try and defend against in terms of whether it was a factual sufficiency, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's saying, I don't know which of these that the jury, or excuse me, that the members convicted based on, and so I don't know how to basically attack the factual sufficiency at the CCA level. I mean, that's what you say. And my question is each of these acts, the evidence supporting it was exactly the same, wasn't it? It was all the testimony of the putative victim?
Right, but here's,
just logically, how are you any better or worse off with respect to any of the three acts?
The problem is that he was acquitted of rape. And, of course, penetration is an element of rape. And yet the judge instructs, as a lesser included offense, that insertion of the penis would support a conviction of indecent assault. And so, at least for me, conceptually, it's difficult to understand that distinction and why she was drawing that distinction. Also, the fact that you have the alleged victim saying that there were two different points in which his penis was inserted. Now, if he had an instruction that simply said, if you find that he inserted his finger into her vagina, and that's an indecent assault without consenting other instructions, then I think I would probably not have an issue. But the issue I have is that the acquitted of the rape, which requires insertion of the penis in her vagina, and then they turn around and the judge tells him, however, you can convict him of indecent assault by either putting his finger in the vagina or his penis in the vagina. And so that's what led to a lot of the ambiguity. And perhaps I maybe didn't frame the issue as well as I should have in the brief, but I think the bottom line is we have an ambiguous verdict. We have an instruction that did not tell the members that they had to concur by two-thirds vote, which occurred factually. And we have a case law here from the Ninth Circuit that I think takes the very focus of the point that we want to make here and apply arising in that setting, and it should be considered as persuasive authority, I think, in this setting as well.
Just so that I'm clear on this, are you suggesting that the members could not have acquitted him of rape and found him guilty of indecent assault by inserting his penis in her vagina?
No.
Okay, so that's not your assertion.
That's not my assertion. My assertion is here that we have three different factual scenarios given by the judge in the disjunctive, and that we don't know if the members agreed by two-thirds vote on one of those three. And obviously,
you're arguing not just that they have to agree by two-thirds vote on each element of the offense, but they have to agree by two-thirds vote on each fact that underpins each element of the offense.
Right.
That's what you're arguing, correct?
That's what I'm arguing, and my time is up right now, but can I respond to that in just one additional way?
Respond to your own argument? Sure.
I'll respond whatever time you give me. I'll take it.
If you're responding to your own argument, why don't you save that for rebuttal, please? If you're responding to Judge Baker, you can respond to him now.
I didn't ask a question. I asked him if I was accurately characterizing his position. The answer was yes.
All right. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Johnson, along with Major Elizabeth Murata, representing the United States. The military judge did not err instructing the panel that could convict the appellant of indecent assault without voting on the underlying factual scenarios. Instructions on lesser included offenses are required unless affirmatively waived by the defense. The standard review for instructional error is de novo. The military judge did not err in this instruction for three reasons. One, the instruction was required and proper. Two, the panel's finding was clear and unambiguous. Three, the military judge's lesser-included offense instruction did not retroactively create a duplicitous specification. The military judge is more than a mere referee. Rule Court Martial 920E requires a military judge to instruct on lesser-included offenses unless affirmatively waived by the defense or barred by the statute of limitations. In this case, the evidence reasonably raised the lesser-included offense of indecent assault. The military judge complied with her sua sponte duty to instruct based on the evidence raised at trial. Appellant conceded that the instruction was a correct statement of the law. All parties agreed that the findings worksheet would not delineate the acts. The panel returned a verdict of indecent assault and a general finding, and their finding was clear and unambiguous. Appellant did not object to the worksheet, and he did not ask for clarification of the panel's finding, because none of the parties were confused that the verdict was, as it was stated, that he was convicted of indecent assault. Under Williams, Vidal, and Holt, it does not matter what specific conduct supported the panel's finding. This court has not required the government to elect one theory of liability, nor to elect separate acts where the evidence supports a single transactional theory. In this case, the underlying acts constitute a single transaction, are closely related in time, and do not have to be separated for prosecution or for findings. The military judge's instruction did not retroactively create a duplicitous specification. Appellant received notice, properly defended, and is not subject to double jeopardy. The appellant's reliance on the Walters case does not apply. The government did not charge indecent assault on diverse occasions, and the evidence supports the panel's finding using any of the underlying factual scenarios. An acquittal of rape does not prevent a guilty finding on the lesser-included offense of indecent assault. Indecent assault has long been considered a lesser-included offense of rape.
I use that.
That's the Wilson case, Your Honor. And the court's finding in that case, the appellant in the Wilson case also challenged that acquittal of rape was inconsistent with the lesser-included offense of indecent assault, where the only underlying act was penetration. And the court indicated there that it's long been considered a lesser-included offense, and that for reasons the panel makes its decision based on just because you didn't prove either force or lack of consent doesn't mean that you can't be then convicted based on penetration for indecent assault. That's been that was considered okay in the Wilson case.
Is it the government's position that it's a lesser included, that indecent assault is a lesser included offense of rape because it's listed in the MCM as an LIO?
That is one. The lesser included offense law was developed out of common law. It's also listed in the manual for courts martial, but it's also been long recognized by this court as a lesser included offense, and that was kind of a tradition of common law. So there's more than one basis for considering that a lesser included offense. Military judge's instruction on the lesser-included offense of indecent assault did not retroactively create a duplicitous specification where appellant stood charged with the greater offense of rape. The lesser-included offense instruction was required and proper, the panel's finding was clear and unambiguous, and this court should affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Any questions? Opportunity for rebuttal from the appellant's counsel.
I'm going to go back to the Shaw decision versus Arizona. First of all, in that opinion, which is at 111 Supreme Court 2503, the Supreme Court said it is impossible to lay down any single analytical model for determining when two means are so separate as to exemplify two inherently separate offenses. And so our position here is that you have two distinct occasions, even though it's the same day, where the first claim of penetration occurred, then he left, went off and made a phone call, and then he came back later on. And it's not clear exactly how much time elapsed from the record when he came back and then allegedly inserted his appeals, but not his finger on a separate occasion. So my first counter to the government's argument is that this is not one continuous event. But that's partly why there's ambiguity here in terms of whether or not, as the members looked at this, did they believe her on the insertion of the finger? Did they believe her on the insertion of the penis on the first occasion they were together? Or did they believe her on the second occasion in which she came back that same day and then inserted his penis in her? Now, the other key point here...
So are you arguing that they should have charged him with two separate offenses?
Well, no, the government can charge it however they want, and then the defense can respond. So I'm not saying how they should have charged it. I'm just saying this is the way they charged it, and so that's the dance with the one with meaning. The other thing is that Justice Scalia, when he voted the way he did in Shaw, he gave an illustration, a charred bottle illustration, where clearly there's a death, clearly there's a homicide. And so he voted the way he did because they were basically a federal Supreme Court looking at the state law and what's the history of the state law relative to immigration. It really wasn't focused on a factual kind of issue. But here's the point. Scalia was saying there's a dead body here. We have a crime. And so whether we call it premeditated murder, whether we call it felony murder, I don't have a problem with upholding this conviction. The problem in my client's case, though, is we don't clearly have a crime. In other words, we just have this testimony that there was an indecent assault. But it's not as though she was found unconscious, bleeding, and had clearly been assaulted. And so I think that in the context of the facts of this case, you have a completely different setting. And I hope that answers the question, Judge Stuckey, about you know, the applicability of Shaw v. Arizona. In terms of the Walters, I basically, maybe I spent too much time on Walters in my brief, and the court thinks that that's what we're relying on. So basically our argument for this case. We're just bringing that up by analogy. Because clearly this case was not a diverse occasion specification where the members accepted the diverse and essentially found the accused guilty of a single.
So you're not asking us to extend Walters to this?
No.
So, okay.
No, and that's why I came back and started out bringing up the Ninth Circuit opinion, because as I went back and looked at everything and preparing for oral arguments, sometimes you brings clarity, at least in my mind, about clarity more to me, that the Ninth Circuit decision, I think, at least as the issue is set up in that case, really applies to the situation that we have here.
Counsel,
this court to file a decision.
Without regard to the specific types of touchings, we have an assault case with multiple touchings over a period of time. What principle are you asking the court to apply in requiring, as you are requesting, that there be a separate vote on each touching? What's the principle that you're asking us to apply?
Then the problem in this case is that the judge, by her instruction, essentially created a duplicitous pleading, different offenses. And the appellate courts have said, when you have multiple offenses within a single specification, you have to be satisfied that the jury agreed. So in cases by unanimous verdict, or the military by two-thirds verdict. And the appellate courts have to be able to look and say there's no ambiguity here in terms of what they found and whether they found the judge's instruction.
So what instruction could the judge give and avoided this?
In fact, one of the cases I cite in my brief is an illustration of the instruction, where it was a federal court decision where there were two drug offenses, and the judge gave the correct instruction in that case. He said, you have to, they determined it was a duplicitous pleading, and the judge says, you have to find unanimously that he did the first one, or you have to find unanimously that he did the second one.
So your answer is, there's no instruction that can be given without the requirement of the separate votes.
That's correct.
Okay.
In the context of this case.
I understand your position. Thank you. If you'd like to conclude, you can take a moment.
Reverse my client's conviction of indecent assault because it's consistent with the facts in it.
Thank you. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. That concludes this week's arguments, and the court will stand in recess.